Opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of Union Broadcasting, Inc., Hot Talk 1510 KCTE, or its employees. The host is solely responsible for the on-air content.
Good morning and welcome to The Entrepreneur Machine, brought to you by the DVS Group. My name is Tom Tilley and I'm one of the principals of the DVS Group and the host of today's show. Today, I'm joined by Pat Trisla, founder and managing partner of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm focused on middle market transactions. Good morning, Pat.
Morning, Tom.
How you doing today?
Doing very well.
Good. Before we get into everything, for the new listeners to the Entrepreneur Machine radio show, the premise of the show is to educate our listeners on all aspects involved with buying, selling, and financing a business acquisition. Most of the content of the Entrepreneur Machine show focuses on transactions between $2 million and $15 million. These are typically the sale of privately held companies to individual entrepreneurs or small investor groups. However, today we're fortunate to have Pat on the show to discuss the next level, which is the middle market transactions. Pat will be giving us his perspective on what happened in the capital markets during the economic meltdown, what's happening today in terms of transaction activity, and how long it may take to see previous levels of transaction activity. Pat, before we get into all of that, because we could go in a lot of directions today, let's talk about Frontier Investment Banking, a little bit about your background and your team.
Well, I've been doing mergers and acquisitions for 21 years plus now, I guess. I started as an attorney, and I guess can be defined as a recovering attorney. Practiced mergers and acquisition and corporate finance and started investment banking about 12 years ago. So Frontier Investment Banking is kind of, as you mentioned, is focused on kind of lower middle market to middle market transactions. We might define, you know, that space is somewhere between 15 and 250 or $500 million. We've got, three kind of managing directors, myself, John McGannon, who was formerly with Oppenheimer, Fondstock, B.C. Christopher before, and Jim Shea, who was formerly a public company CFO and supported by a number of investment banking, very talented associate and analyst with the investment banking expertise.
You've got a pretty diverse group there in terms of their backgrounds and experience. Maybe touch a little bit on what makes a good investment banking firm. You know, when I look at you and Jim and John and I look at your backgrounds and you know, if you look at the skill set that everybody seems to have, you know, if you look in general at any firm that's any good, you've got to have that, you know, some finance experience, some transaction experience, some legal experience, et cetera. And maybe talk a little bit about how you guys work together and what makes you a good team.
Right. Thanks. You know, I don't know if it was by design or dumb luck, but we did kind of end up with some complementary backgrounds and expertise amongst kind of the senior team. Myself, as I mentioned, my expertise or background was as an attorney, mergers and acquisition attorney. Jim Shea's background, obviously, is a public company CFO. He was a public company accountant or CPA prior to that. And so his background is in accounting. John owned a company and successfully sold it and went into investment banking and at Oppenheimer, you know, did mergers and acquisitions in addition to larger kind of capital market corporate finance public offering type transactions. So it is somewhat of a complementary expertise amongst our senior team we're generalists in many respects, having executed transactions in a myriad of industries, and many times those different disciplines come to bear in providing service to our clients.
Well, when you look at a transaction, what's amazing to me is that John would actually want to get into this business after having gone through it himself through a transaction. Let's talk a little bit about the various aspects of a transaction from when we're talking about an acquisition. You know, just break it down maybe very simply in the segments so people understand. Because one of the things that we see is that, and I don't know how it is in the middle market arena, is probably a little bit more sophistication. But what we see on the lower end is a lot of business owners approach it from the standpoint of like they're selling a car or a house, and they don't understand how long that process can be, the stages to it, and all the landmines along the way that can blow a deal up.
Sure. Well, I mean, it probably makes first to make a distinction between the type of process that's undertaken when selling a business in a negotiated sale and versus an investment banking process. The transaction will take as long as the negotiation and due diligence takes prior to closing. And when I refer to negotiated sale, that's usually one party sitting across the table, a potential buyer, which talking with a potential seller, maybe even a couple of potential buyers talking to the seller, and you kind of negotiate in a one-off fashion to try and reach that common ground where both parties are willing to do a deal, and then so that there's a lot of factors that go into the timing there, but certainly if you're all things being equal, if you run an investment banking process, which is what the crux of how we add value for our clients, that's going to take quite a bit more time. And in that, what we're doing is we're if it's a sell side opportunity, then we're first of all doing the due diligence on our client, the type of due diligence that a buyer would do, so that we're able to tell the story to potential buyers, amplifying the company's strengths, exposing and managing to the company's weaknesses, and then telling that story to all of the first and at the same time, I guess, identifying all of the potential buyers, both strategic and financial, and we pride ourselves in finding the atypical strategic and atypical financial buyers, bringing all those buyers together. Sharing that story with them and finding basically the most motivated party and how that is found and how value is driven is the competitive tension of having multiple parties looking at an opportunity that they like or are interested in that requires those buyers to maximize their view of the selling client. And as a result, you're going to get people to their best and final. Something that's very difficult in a negotiated transaction is to ever get. You never know when that person's at a best and final. And when you run a process and you tell folks, we need your indication of interest by such and such a date, or we need you to up your offers after the management presentation after having met management, and then you're going to get. You're going to get more likely than not their best and final because they realize that this deal is going to be moving away from them, and so as a result. You're going to find that most motivated party that will hopefully achieve your client's objectives, which many times or most times involves highest valuation, but also involves many other factors. So your question's a good one about timing, and I apologize for the little bit of a non sequitur. But when you're talking about running an investment banking process, I mean, all things being equal, depending on a number of factors, it could increase more likely, but certainly it could potentially decrease it. But from the time you're beginning due diligence to the time you're probably closing, it's at least 6 to 8 months if you're going to optimize value during that time. In a negotiated deal, you could come to a meeting of the minds in a couple of weeks and go to a letter of intent or not even go to a letter of intent and start into kind of negotiations for the definitive document and while due diligence is going on. And that might be more of a 60, 90-day, 120-day process. So it's all different, but certainly a negotiated sale is different than the investment banking process that we tend to run for the benefit of our clients.
Let's talk about the thresholds of, and we'll get further into the similarities and differences between a negotiated sale, say in the small market versus the controlled auction process of the middle market. But let's define kind of what the delineation is between a small market company and a middle market company or transaction, because a lot of times when I'm talking to prospective sellers, they've heard about investment banking, they've heard about the high multiples, and they think, well, that's let's do that with my company, and having to have the frank discussion of, you're not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's really up to everybody's got different definitions of what they are, and different private equity firms and strategic buyers will go smaller. Everybody has a lower end threshold or typically has a minimum kind of threshold criteria that they need to meet. But, on average, and this has increased over the last couple of years, it used to be you had $1 million in EBITDA in an industry that wasn't too highly regulated. You could probably run a fairly competitive process of north of 75, maybe or certainly or perhaps north of 100 financially qualified and interested buyers, But that's snuck up quite a bit anymore. And so anymore, really $3 million in EBITDA, EBITDA being a proxy for cash flow that a business kicks off, and EBITDA is an acronym for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And certainly $5 million would be one. If you've got a north of $5 million in EBITDA, you're almost certainly can run a very frothy competitive process. But having said that, there's always the flip side of the market. Private equity firms, there's so much money on the sidelines. And, the $100 million fund that was successful went out and raised a second fund of $250 million, but they didn't add any extra people. So what happened was their deal criteria moved up market. So now instead of doing $1 million deal minimum, they have to do a $3 million minimum or a $5 million deal minimum. And the $500 million private equity firm that was successful raised a $1 billion fund, et cetera. And so it becomes, excuse me, very competitive for the private equity firms. And a number have, again, it found it to be very competitive to try and buy quality companies. And so they have tried to be contrarians. And there are more smaller funds that have popped up that will do $1 million EBITDA funds. But if you looked at from a majority basis or a percentage basis, certainly the vast, vast majority are doing larger deals, maybe $3 million, maybe if you want to, many down to $2 million in EBITDA, but really $3 million and $5 million $1 million in EBITDA is kind of become the new floor for many of those that are financial buyers. And certainly the strategic buyers have their own internal criteria. But when you figure that they're using, lawyers that probably charge, $500, $600 an hour, and accountants that are charging somewhere close to that, they're not going to want to do too small of a deal because their transaction costs could eat up the value of the deal if they're buying an $800,000 EBITDA company or something like that.
That's great. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on what's going on in the investment banking world. You're listening to The Entrepreneur Machine on 1510 KCTE with Tom Tilley and special guest Pat Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking, brought to you by the DVS Group, a transaction closing, not consulting firm.
Are you a homeowner with a slate or tile roof that needs repair? Has the weather caused unexpected leaks or cracks in your slate or tile roof? If so, you need to call Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing, Kansas City's leading slate and tile roofing company. Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing services include specialized slate and tile re-roofing, new slate and tile installation, and warranted repairs. Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing's fully insured workers are the Kansas City experts that give your roof the attention it deserves. Call 816-587-7663 or visit ambassadorroofing.com to contact Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing for all your slate and tile roofing needs. That's 816-587-7663 or ambassadorroofing.com.
In 1999, I hurt myself. Our family doctor, on painkillers, took it as directed. By the time 2004 came, I was 310 pounds. I stayed home every day, and I was reduced to a bottle of water and pain pills, 70, 80, 100.
Mike was one of the millions of Americans addicted to opioid prescription painkillers.
So I decided one day that I was going to stop taking it. And by that evening, I was down on the floor in withdrawals. And it became very obvious, very fast, that it was a chronic disease. It was not a choice. I had to get better.
Mike has not misused opioid drugs since beginning office-based treatment with his doctor in 2006. To learn more, visit naabt.org.
Being able to visit a doctor like an ordinary patient has made all the difference in the world in my recovery. Future looks good again.
That's naabt.org.
With 160 years of experience and 700 corporate clients across 20 states, Tax Favored Benefits focuses on gaining a deep understanding of your financial priorities and objectives, choosing investment and financial products that best match your goals, and providing the best possible program for you and your company in today's complex financial environment. To find out more about their pension, profit sharing, employees' benefits, and investment plans, visit them online at taxfavoredbenefits.com or call 913-648-5526.
Dennis Miller.
I guess now we're going to play the same game with Somali pirates that we do with the L.A. carjackers, where we wait till they run out of fuel. Anybody else being driven crazy by this? Why don't we just get this over with right now, take these five guys when we get them, tie them up to four cabin cruisers, and then everybody takes off in a separate direction.
Dennis Miller weekdays 10 to noon on Hot Talk 1510 KCTE.
Mostly cloudy today, 76 for the high, 57 tonight, a 40% chance for thunderstorms, and 75 tomorrow. I'm Dennis Rooney, Hot Talk 1510 KCTE.
Welcome back to the Entrepreneur Machine, brought to you by the DVS Group, a leading small market business acquisition firm. I'm your host, Tom Tilley, along with special guest Pat Trisla, founder and managing partner of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm. Pat, prior to the break, we were discussing private equity groups and what levels of EBITDA or cash flow that those companies typically looked at. You brought up a couple of good points. Let's talk first about private equity money, where it comes from, and then let's talk a little bit more about what's been happening in that world, which has been impacting transactions.
Sure. The private equity funds, like many of the terms in our space, have kind of a loose definition, but we're typically talking about the ones that have gone to institutional investors, insurance companies, super accredited or wealthy individuals that place their money with the private equity firm as part of their overall portfolio allocation. They're going to have equity, they're going to have bonds, they're going to have real estate, and then they're going to have perhaps some alternative investments like a private equity fund. And the promise, general promise of a private equity fund is put your money with us, whatever their investment horizon is, typically 3 to 5 or 7 years, we'll get it back to you in 3 to 5 or 7 years at a internal rate of return of somewhere between 25% to 35% is kind of what many of them target. The private equity firms, and those are pretty lofty returns. In order to get that done, you're going to have to have a monetization event somewhere down the line in 3 to 5 or 7 years, whatever the investment horizon might be, that allows you to realize that return. And so there's a couple high level ways to get that done. And one is, buy the thing right. And private equity firms try to, obviously, they're smart. That's what's all they do for a living. And they try to buy everything as low as possible. So there's some arbitrage in the purchase price. So when they go to sell it, they reap that arbitrage. Or to grow the company either organically just through growing the business, or inorganically by acquiring other businesses. And quite frankly, because that's what they do for the living, that is more likely than not the strategy, to buy a platform company in a space, find other add-on or bolt-on acquisitions to expand the EBITDA of their portfolio company, and sell that company with a larger EBITDA somewhere down the line at a higher multiple than they paid, and thereby reaping the rate of return for their investors.
Okay. Well, first of all, define arbitrage for people. Sure. Because a lot of people might not know that.
That's a difficult one. Someone asked me that one. In general, I would just say, for purposes of this discussion, it's buying something for less than it's truly worth, and then selling it, hopefully selling it for at least what it's worth or something more. So arbitrage, it means different things in different markets, but it basically means that you've got a price advantage kind of going in. And that's where, not to beat the drum, but if you seek a competitive process and you look at alternatives and you move people to their best and final, you're gonna wring out the arbitrage and hopefully sell at a premium. And quite frankly, that's what the process is designed to do when we're doing a controlled auction, as you referenced it earlier. But that's kind of the private equity game. And there are a lot of private equity firms out there with a lot of money to put to work, but they look for certain companies and a certain quality of company for them to invest in. The good thing is that private equity firms come in all shapes and sizes. There are those that are really generalists, and they'll look at, they'll swear off certain type of industries that they think are real problematic for their skill set, or for their investment thesis, but then there are others that are very focused that will do nothing but healthcare and nothing but media and entertainment, etc.
For the listeners who just joined the program, you're listening to the Entrepreneur Machine on radio show on 1510 KCTE. I'm host Tom Tilley with my special guest Pat Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm. We've been talking about the middle market transaction world, Pat, and one of the interesting things to me was when we were, before the show, we were talking about the expectations of return on investment by private equity groups. And, people who are in the stock market or who have investments of any kind are looking and they start to think, wow, if I could get 8%, especially these days. If I can get 8% return or 10% return on my money, I'm going to be a happy guy, you know, when it comes to retirement time. These 25 to 35% expectations that the private equity group set, one of the interesting things to me was I understood it in the world 2 years ago when you could leverage a deal by putting less equity in. So if I'm talking to our listeners and saying, well, what's that mean? You're talking about, you know, you didn't have to put as much equity into a deal to get a big deal done, let's say, and maybe talk a little bit about those percentages in a second. But then the flip side of what I couldn't understand was how do you get 25 to 35% returns in an environment like today? So maybe talk a little bit about both those scenarios.
Sure. First of all, I think they state that their objectives are to hit 25 to 35%. I think if you looked at some of the raw data, and it's difficult to get to those because they're private and their returns are private, I think on average that they're probably not achieving those on average with the private equity firms. But we all fall short of our aspirations. But, you know, in order to get premium type returns like that, you know, there's a number of different things that they try to bring to bear. One is an operational or financial discipline to a company that really expands and maximizes the use of cash for a company, in the process expands the EBITDA or the proxy for cash flow. And so that's something that they try to do on an operational basis. Others also do a lot of think tank stuff where they will do, an entrepreneur is busy delivering on a daily basis the products and services that his clients expect. They'll do some strategic thinking about some areas that the company should grow organically in order to increase its value. But again, as I mentioned before, at the end of the day, many are looking to add on to other acquisitions. And, you know, if you buy a platform we'll talk about this market and what are happening with multiples. But if you buy a platform for five times and you go do a couple other add-ons at three times, 3.5, they're smaller ones, and you're able to combine those. Many times, you know, you only need one CFO, one president, so there's going to be natural day two, the day after the acquisition synergies, where cost synergies, where all of a sudden that, you know, if you bought $1 million EBITDA company, it becomes a $1.5, $2 million EBITDA company because you wrung out some of the costs, or you can take a product and service and sell it through your channels. And so you buy a $5 million EBITDA company, you make a couple different acquisitions, all of a sudden you got a $10 million EBITDA company, and you bought it at five and you sell it at seven or eight, and you do the math and the return will be there. So, that's where they're trying to get with those things, with their investments. They're trying to find, and everybody's got a different investment thesis. Some pride themselves on buying companies that are not optimized from a management perspective because they want to bring optimal management discipline to the portfolio company. Many others are looking at it simply to, we want to find the right platform as the first step into this particular niche so we can acquire some other companies.
You talk about platform companies, portfolio companies. Just for clarification, portfolio companies being companies that are held within a private equity group. Platform company being the one which is the foundation for people to build off of when you say they're going to make that acquisition. But one of the interesting things you mentioned and I never really thought of was, in a market like today, the businesses are selling for a lower multiple, or they can drive a lower multiple in negotiation, which gives you that arbitrage of giving them that head start on gaining those returns as well. Because I kept my mind kept going, well, you know, if you put a lot less equity in, now they're having to put more equity in, and we'll get to that in talking about the financial markets here in a minute. But that was an interesting statement, Pat, that you made that I didn't even think about how the multiples have come down. Why don't you talk about multiples and first of all, define what the multiple that we're talking about is so people can understand that.
Sure. A common metric used in selling a company is a multiple of cash flow or a multiple of EBITDA. Free cash flow might be EBITDA minus capital expenditures of a business to kind of get it normalized. You know, what does this business kick off from a cash perspective on a regular basis, and most importantly, on a go forward basis? And then, buyers are typically they're doing a number of different analyses, but one of the key valuation metrics is looking at the free cash flow and paying a multiple for it. And, you know, what happened in the previous market, really the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy and the credit crisis, was, you know, if you could come in and buy a company, say it's a $5 million EBITDA company, and you could pay one times EBITDA, or you could put in one times EBITDA with respect to equity, and you get, so you put $5 million in, and you can go to a bank and get five or six times, or sometimes higher than that, senior leverage. In other words, they will give you a loan that is five to six times that EBITDA. It allows you to pay a lot more for a company, and your return is based on the equity that you have in the portfolio company that you just invested in or just bought, and as a result, that is assuming that you're going to pay the debt off in time and not have any problems. So you're able to take that equity and leverage it up and get your returns that way. In this environment, because of the credit crisis, and we can get into that a little bit more about how the senior markets have, you know, certainly in my couple decades plus of mergers and acquisitions, I've never seen a senior credit market like this that's as challenging as it is today. It makes it very difficult. Credit availability is down. Credit tightening is certainly the norm, such that folks are going to look at a certain collateral profile of a say an acquisition target. And so if I'm a senior, if I'm a bank or a other senior lender, and I'm looking at an acquisition target, and I'm going to finance your company, Tom, their acquisition of this particular target, I'm going to look at the collateral, perhaps certainly, and or more likely than not, and then I'm also going to look at the EBITDA. And I'm going to make some valuation as to how much I'm going to lend based on that collateral profile and that free cash flow profile. And those numbers, those multiples that senior lenders that are lending, and that's a just a fraction of those that were really lending in the other market, particularly in the upper end of the middle market. You've got a difficult situation there where senior banks are now lending at maybe two, as low as two, sometimes two and a half, maybe three, four and a half tops, which is a far cry from the five, six, seven, eight, even 10 multiples that were being used before by senior lenders. And as a result, if a private equity firm is going to get their return in this market, one of the things that they're going to bank on is they're going to try and buy low. They're kind of trying to bake in some of that return by buying low, whereas a company that they saw in the previous market, if you will, might have traded for six times, they might be able to get it for four times now.
Great. We'll talk about how to close that gap in a minute with other financing. We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on the investment banking world today. You're listening to the Entrepreneur Machine Show on 1510 KCTE with Tom Tilley and special guest Pat Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking.
Greg Gurley here, former KU basketball player, and I'm here with sales author Brian Sullivan to talk about how great salespeople are a lot like great athletes. They realize the talent alone doesn't win national championships.
Hey, it's true, Greg, especially in this tough economy. I mean, now more than ever, business owners, entrepreneurs, and salespeople need specific tactics and strategies to attack the marketplace.
And Sully, salespeople, just like great basketball teams, can't get passive when the game is tough. They need to find innovative ways to find new prospects, better ways to market themselves, and creative ways to increase business without discounting.
Well, Greg, I've got the way, buddy. You see, just as great basketball teams have camp before the season, we too have a skill-building camp for business professionals looking to become top sales performers.
Just go to sellhardplayhard.com to join us on June 11th at Lock Lloyd Country Club for a morning of intense training and then an afternoon of business networking. We guarantee it will be the best training event you've ever attended.
Space is limited, so sign up at sellhardplayhard.com.
Introducing an eco-friendly first, 360 Vodka. It's quadruple distilled and five times filtered. Design and production exhibit the highest degree of sustainability. It is the evolution of vodka. 360, the world's first eco-friendly premium vodka. Saving the planet, one glass at a time.
360 Vodka, distilled from grain, 40% alcohol by volume, Earth-Friendly Distilling Company, Weston, Missouri.
Every day, more than 2,000 children may be reported missing in the U.S. Thankfully, the vast majority are recovered quickly. My name is Kira Sedgwick, and as a parent, my top concern is keeping my children safer. Did you know that your children are never too old for you to talk to them about safety? Regardless of their age, there are always new experiences that have the potential to impact your children's safety. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and Duracell are again partnering through the Power of Parents program to help provide families with valuable tips on how you can talk to your children about their safety and technologies that can help keep your children safer. To help guide parents through these conversations with their children, whether they are 6 or 16 years old, a free downloadable handbook is available at powerofparentsonline.com. Take time today to review this important safety information with your family. It may be the most precious time you spend together.
Total Health with Coach K, Rob Kingsbury.
You happen to look in the Kansas City Star today. 7 years ago, maybe 6.5 years ago, I made a comment. Pharmaceutical drugs are in our waterways. And along comes this article today. Simply says drugs in the water. They're finding 271 million pounds of pharmaceuticals dumped into the waterways every year. Numbers don't lie. You and I drink it every day.
Listen to Total Health weekdays at 2 on Hot Talk 1510.
Slight chance for a shower today, otherwise mostly cloudy. 76 today, 57 overnight, then a better chance for thunderstorms and 75 tomorrow. I'm Dennis Rooney, Hot Talk 1510 KCTE.
Welcome back to the Entrepreneur Machine, brought to you by the DVS Group, a leading small market business acquisition firm. I'm your host, Tom Tilley, along with special guest Pat Trisla, founder and managing partner of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm. Pat, prior to the break, we were talking about pricing and multiples of business in the middle market. And again, I'll have you touch a little bit on middle market for people who just maybe joined us. But let's talk a little bit about pricing, a little bit about deal structure, and then let's help people understand why and how the financial crisis has impacted the investment banking world. And feel free to start on any one of those three.
How much time do you have? Well, you know, pricing is, it probably makes sense to start there, because we were talking about really the multiples that banks were lending on nowadays. And you know, the middle market, I guess to touch on that too, you know, middle market is defined in many different ways. We tend to define it somewhere between, you know, transactions in value between 15 and 250 or 500 million. Most of our stuff occurs in the lower than 250. But when you look at pricing, and you look at the capital structure of acquisition financing, certainly, equity drives the deal. They're the ones that are calling the shots and pulling the trigger if it goes forward. But you can't get that done. Well, there's always exceptions to the rule, and we're experiencing one with one of our clients right now. But you can't get that done if you don't have senior financing. That leverage is essential for business. You know, day to day business and funding businesses going forward. It's also essential to the M&A market. And if you've got multiples that are down one turn or, you know, two turns, when we say that, is if prior market for a particular company, the lending multiple for a senior financier would be somewhere between 4 to 6 times EBITDA, and now they're, you know, say, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 or 2.5 to 4 times EBITDA, you can't get as much senior financing for the amount of equity that you put in, so you can't pay as much for the company. Or if you still want to buy the company and you have to pay more, you're either going to have to put more equity in, which drives down your returns as a buyer, or you're going to have to you're going to have to put in a slice of mezzanine, which we can talk about. But in short, the pricing pricing has slipped, and it slipped primarily because of the senior financing market and the lack of credit availability and the credit tightening standards.
Let's clear up some definitions here. So equity being the cash that the private equity group brings to the table.
Or the strategic buyer. Sure. You know, if it's a public company or if it's a larger strategic, we're talking about if I'm the buyer and I have to write, and it's a $50 million acquisition purchase price, and I have to write a $10 million check, then I've got $10 million into it for a purchase price of $50. And where's the remaining $40 coming from? Is it coming from all senior financing?
Or define senior financing, just for people.
You know, sure, and that's for the middle market, too. You're really talking about, more likely than not, you're talking about local or regional banks, regulated banks that are making the loan, but there's also other financial or institutional lenders that will lend just like a bank and take a first priority lien on the assets and have that first priority position. So when you're talking about the senior financing, you're primarily talking about banks in the lower middle market. And that's why we haven't touched upon this much, but that's why, notwithstanding what the popular financial press will tell you that M&A is dead or M&A has been punched in the gut, certainly it has taken a hit. But that's really the larger market. And the larger market is financed by the major money center banks and the major institutional lenders, and they're the ones that were part of the subprime securitization credit swap, debacle that kind of drove a lot of this credit crisis. The local or regional banks were small enough that they didn't have positions on those toxic assets, and as a result, they're still out there lending, but they have tightened their credit standards due to the recession that we're in, because a given company is not going to, more likely than not, unless they're in a defensive or counter-cyclical business, they're not going to perform like they did in the prior non-recessionary market.
So in the typical transaction structure, you had the equity or capital that the group is bringing to the table. You had the senior or traditional bank financing. In some cases, there might need to close a gap on the purchase price versus what the senior and the equity coming in would be. In comes the mezzanine piece. Let's talk a little bit about how structures have changed and how all those kind of come together in terms of multiples going down. Because once the senior money goes away or becomes tightened or less, if the senior lender's not bringing as much money to the table, how do you get deals done?
Sure. Again, there's probably two answers to that. On the pricing structure, because there's a deal structure component that's happening in this market too. But in the pricing structure, to use that example, if you had a $50 million acquisition price, $10 million of equity, and you're hoping to get $40 million of senior financing from your friendly bank, and they're going to give you three times. So you're $10 million short. How are you going to make that up? More likely than not, the buyer will have to put in a little more equity themselves, but they'll also go out and probably get a strip of mezzanine. And mezzanine is part debt, part equity. A mezzanine investor will typically invest the money and expects you to pay back at a higher interest rate, certainly because it's a higher risk than your senior financing, but expects you to pay back interest on that principal. But typically, they won't amortize the debt for the time period, and it'll be payable in a balloon 3 to 5 years later. And so the mezzanine provider looks at their return coming from the payment of interest on the money that they provided. So if we were to use that example, if they provided $5 million of mezzanine and the equity put in 15 of equity and the rest was senior financing, they'd be expecting to get paid their interest on the $5 million with a balloon payment of that $5 million at the end of the term. But the other component, return component for the mezzanine provider, are warrants or equity. And it gets into deal structuring. If it's an LLC, they're going to probably take equity. If it's a corporation, they're going to take warrants for tax reasons. But basically, what they're getting a current pay on the interest payment or the debt repayment, if you will, and they're getting an equity kicker through the warrant or the equity that they take. So it's a blended return. And the reason that equity would do that is because it's not as dilutive to them, because a portion of that, if they can pay off the debt, they only give up a little bit of equity to the mezzanine provider, as opposed to having to put in $5 million themselves and then have to get the return on that additional $5 million when it already might be kind of a dicey situation for purposes of getting their targeted return.
What's interesting for me is that some of our smaller transactions, say $10 to $15 million transaction, in a lot of cases we're dealing with an entrepreneur who might have $2 million of their own equity to put in. And when they hear the interest rates that mezzanine funds get, they can't believe, because their mind goes, well, if the senior person's only getting whatever 6% or 5% or whatever today's interest rates are, and I've got to pay a mezzanine fund 12-14%, how can I make that happen with my debt service? How does that work?
Well, first of all, you have to have the cash flow to be able to pay that back, and part of the function of banks and mezzanine providers in this market is keeps people out of bad transactions or bad acquisitions by not lending or not committing capital where it can't get returned. So you'd have to have a business that kicked off cash and the interest coverage and or the total funded debt to EBITDA ratio coverage would have to be such that, I guess another way to put that is you have to, your business have to kick off enough cash to comfortably pay your senior and your mezzanine provider. Otherwise, the mezz is probably not going to give you the money. And that 12 to 14% is expensive. But if you look at the returns, if you can pay off that 12, if you pay off that 12 to 14% and you only had to give up a couple of points of equity and then you sell the business and you reap that multiple on the sale of the business, that's where the mezzanine makes sense, because it wasn't as dilutive as another strip of equity from another equity provider or yourself putting it in. So on the short-term analysis, the mezzanine can crimp your cash flow, available free cash flow after paying the debt. And it's just a decision based on the strategic plans that the acquirer has that needs to be made.
Yeah. For listeners who just joined the program, you're listening to the Entrepreneur Machine Radio Show on 1510 KCTE. I'm your host, Tom Tilley, with my special guest, Pat Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm. Pat, let's switch gears a little bit here. With the credit meltdown, and we could spend a week getting into that, but what changed in investment banking? You referenced Lehman Brothers going down, and talk about kind of the larger market and what happened and the trickle down effect that had in the middle market. And I can talk a little bit about the smaller market.
Sure. What happened is you had the larger senior credit providers really got in trouble with toxic assets. And as a result, as the TARP money came in, people started doing different things with the TARP money. We just successfully completed a senior refinancing engagement for a marquee manufacturing firm. And, in talking to the banks, it was really shocking, because this is not in the popular press, how many banks, number one, have taken TARP money, and probably more shockingly, how many are doing different things with the TARP money. The TARP money could be plugging a hole in their balance sheet. They could be hoarding it for acquisitions of banks, and others could be lending it. But even, I would say, the majority of those that are lending it are primarily lending it to current clients first and foremost, and in part because they owe them that commitment, and in part because they might be triaging a situation where they've got a credit that's in trouble, and they're able to give them a little bit more money just to kind of get refinanced out or something along that line. But at the end of the day, there are people out there lending in the middle market, and it's just there are fewer, so the credit availability is down and the credit standards are tighter.
Well, you mentioned TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. That's an interesting acronym to me that the government's chosen to use TARP to cover up the toxic assets. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on what's happening in the larger investment banking world, how that trickled down to the middle market, and what's going on today. And hopefully, we'll see some light at the end of the tunnel. You're listening to The Entrepreneur Machine on 1510 KCTE with Tom Tilley and special guest Pat Trisla of Frontier Investment Banking.
Are you a homeowner with a slate or tile roof that needs repair? Has the weather caused unexpected leaks or cracks in your slate or tile roof? If so, you need to call Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing, Kansas City's leading slate and tile roofing company. Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing services include specialized slate and tile re-roofing, new slate and tile installation, and warranted repairs. Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing's fully insured workers are the Kansas City experts that give your roof the attention it deserves. Call 816-587-7663 or visit ambassadorroofing.com to contact Ambassador Slate and Tile Roofing for all your slate and tile roofing needs. That's 816-587-7663 or ambassadorroofing.com.
SpiderTel, Kansas City's premier full-service web development company, has been spinning innovative web solutions since 1996.
SpiderTel offers a full suite of services for the small entrepreneur and the large organization alike, including web design and redesign, e-commerce solutions, website hosting, and email services. SpiderTel is renowned for their full-service, hands-on approach to building, branding, maintaining, and marketing websites. If you're on the web already, take advantage of their free website audit. Using over 20 criteria, the SpiderTel experts will evaluate your website and provide you with a customized analysis on how you can maximize your web presence, attract your target market, and gain more customers. If you're new to the web, take advantage of free tools and sign up for their free email newsletter. Call 913-663-4666 for your free consultation or visit SpiderTel.com. That's SpiderTel.com.
It's your home, it's your dream. Great on test and living healthy and clean. Make it green, green, green.
Yeah. Making it green is making sure the air in your home is healthy for your family to breathe. Testing for radon is easy. Just call 866-730-GREEN.
Make it green, green, green.
A message from the US EPA.
Hi, this is David Vanoy Jr. from Door to Door on Hot Talk 1510. Wednesday at 3, we'll have 10 tips to sell your home and the top 8 mistakes that buyers make when looking at foreclosures. And don't forget that we give away Jack Stack Barbecue every week and open the phones to your questions. All the experts say that this is the best time in your lifetime to buy a home, so tune in to the Real Estate Radio Show to discover your opportunities for home ownership. Or if you need real estate advice right now, go to davidvanoyjr.com.
Cloudy today, 76 for the high, 57 overnight. A good chance for a thunderstorm tomorrow and a high of 75. I'm Dennis Rooney, Hot Talk 1510 KCTE.
Welcome back to the Entrepreneur Machine, brought to you by the DBS Group, a leading small market business acquisition firm. I'm your host, Tom Tilley, along with special guest Pat Trissel, a founder and managing partner of Frontier Investment Banking, a Kansas City-based investment banking firm. Pat, prior to the break, we were discussing the financial meltdown and what happened with the larger market investment banking world and how that's likely changed for, if not forever, for the foreseeable future. But the middle market, to your point during the break, really hasn't changed that much other than, you know, fewer lenders, deal structures changing. But talk a little bit about what you're seeing.
Yeah, the middle market deals are still getting done. And, you know, particularly in those industries that are defensive. We've been dumb lucky to have some clients in that and even one in a counter-cyclical industry. But when you, certainly the larger markets, investment banking landscape has changed and probably changed for good as those banks have either gone out of business or going to have to change to some form of bank holding company. But in the middle market, just like the smaller market, the intermediaries will continue to serve their clients and help them optimize their strategic objectives through, you know, sales or recapitalizations or acquisitions or other strategic assignments.
Let's talk about, I mean, you've been in this business for over 20 years. So you've been through some of the ups and downs. And this is, you know, this is, as you mentioned, this is as bad as it's probably ever been in your experience. But in a down economy, let's just say in a down economy versus an up economy, what kind of transactions are you working on? Who are you serving during that time? Because I mean, talk about how that changes based on what's happening in the landscape.
Sure,
the
environment. That's a very good question, and you're probably experiencing something similar in your business. In a normal economy or an up economy, we're probably doing 3/4, 2/3 sell side assignments. Where we're either selling all of a business or making a market for the sale of all the business or making a market for a sale of a percentage of the business through what's called a recapitalization, where a company sells in a minority recapitalization less than 50% of their economic and voting interest, or in a majority recapitalization more than 50% of their voting and economic interest. I would, you know, so in the rest were kind of acquisition financing and other strategic advisory type assignments. But now, we were not by any foresight, but just dumb luck, we ended up with a sell side in the healthcare space that's going to close here in within the next month. That's held together in part because healthcare is defensive, and the healthcare and our clients' numbers have held together through this tough economy. in another space, we're fortunate to have a client in the movie theater space. And if you look at that, that's even proven to be countercyclical. They're setting record revenue numbers and record attendance numbers in this down economy. And so that continues to be, that happens to be a growth capital slash kind of recapitalization type assignment. And you know, again, it's stroke of dumb luck, but we're happy to have it. And then on another one that the assignment started after the credit crisis started was a sell side of a company in the food space. And food, again, is a defensive industry. And as a result, we're actually to the point where we've made the market and we've got double digit offers in that prove that people are still out there doing deals and still interested in quality companies, which our client is in this case. And so that's what we're working on. However, if you look at the new, I mentioned a successful refinancing assignment that we completed earlier this year. If you look at the new engagements that we embarked upon, we have, they're almost, you can almost flip that pie chart around. And instead of doing sell side, we're doing refinancings and acquisition financings. People coming to us, and they've spotted, had discussions with a target, and that target, they'll need to raise outside capital to acquire that target. So they come to us to make a market of all the interested and qualified capital providers, the equity, the mezzanine, and the senior, to have them compete to find out, you know, the most and to achieve for them the most favored structure for their acquisition. So that's how things have changed for us. And I guess as to your point earlier, as an intermediary in the middle market and in anything other than the larger market, our job will continue to be to serve as that advisor to the company that are experts at running their business, but not experts at executing and optimizing in a strategic transaction setting.
Well, part of my takeaway from what you just said is that people are going to watch movies and eating a lot of food. it probably at home as opposed to going out to eat and spending your money on more expensive fun stuff. We talk about the economic ups and downs and the types of transactions that you're working on. What are some other industries, Pat, that you see when you talk countercyclical, and that's what you're talking about with the theaters? People are going to movies more, and it's a less expensive, fun event for a family. What are some other industries that maybe not necessarily countercyclical, but maybe some rising industries that are starting to come on, or ones that have just rebounded during these times?
Yeah, and I want to shoot straight on that. And this certainly is a buyer's market, and we can talk about some of the deal structures where buyers have been able to kind of exert their leverage. So I for our business, we wish there were more countercyclical type industries, but we've seen a couple. One of our clients manufactures a green product that is also a value play. So they have tremendous growth plans because there's obviously the green movement, but also as people start to look at all their costs and if they can get a quality product at a lower price, they're certainly going to go that route. So some people can look at different parts of the energy market. We have a wind energy client, and so that obviously is a favored industry, and you could say that is maybe countercyclical for purposes of this down market, maybe not countercyclical for other markets, just because it's a new play. But the deals are still getting done out there, even in the bread and butters in industries, but certainly in the defensive and countercyclical, if there's a need to seek it, if there's a desire to seek a transaction, you can do it. If there's a need to seek a transaction, you can also do that too. Different settings. If you're going to market and you have to, have to do a transaction because of certain things that are happening to your business, you lose a lot of leverage, obviously, as opposed to somebody who's going to market to achieve some strategic objectives that's their choice to pursue at this time. So
let's talk a little bit more about another side of your shop. I know Jim Shea does a lot of, works with companies. And is this something that you guys are doing a lot more of now, of where people say, I do want to sell, my company's not ready, it's the wrong economy? Talk about Jim, and we've only got a couple minutes, but touch on the value optimization process and what you're trying to accomplish there.
Sure. What we've done is because, Jim has lived that day-to-day management of companies, is we've accepted engagements with clients where we'll work on a value optimization basis, on an hourly basis, and then work with the client to determine the right time to sell the business. And that could be within the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And have the, you know, the terms of the sell side engagement already in place in the engagement letter. And the idea is to get that company ready for sale and to optimize that particular client's objectives through the sale or through the whatever the quasi monetization event or full monetization event might be. So it allows us to get in earlier and affect companies and if you will, clean them up before we take them to market. And it's been, I think, incredibly valuable. Hopefully it's been valuable for our clients. The feedback has been that it's valuable, and we think it's an added service that we can offer.
Well, we always talk about value drivers and helping our clients understand those and two areas that can help, obviously, Pat. One, in driving a higher multiple, and number two, driving that higher purchase price. Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Entrepreneur Machine Radio Show. Pat, thank you so much for joining us. Great, valuable information. The takeaway, again, deals are getting done today. Please join us again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Our upcoming guests include Steve Brown, estate planning attorney with Brown & Vogel Law Firm. He'll be talking about exit planning. Also, in the next few weeks, we'll have Bill Hinkle, Small Business Administration financing expert, to discuss the changes at the SBA as well as the process of SBA financing. Thank you.
Cloudy today with a slight chance for a shower, 76 for the high, 57 tonight, 75 tomorrow with about a 40% chance for a storm. I'm Dennis Ernie, Hot Talk 1510.
You're listening to